In the waning days of his presidency, John Adams had a problem. He couldn't identify somebody to appoint Chief Justice of the United States. And so, in several sessions, he and his Secretary of State, John Marshall, former congressman from Virginia, discussed the question. According to Marshall, finally on one occasion, after yet another candidate's name had been scratched off the list, Adams turned to Marshall and said, "Well, then I suppose I'm going to have to appoint you." With that, Marshall supposedly bowed and backed out of the room without answering. Soon enough, however, Adams sent Marshall's name to the Supreme Court, to the Senate for its consideration, and ultimately John Marshall became Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Marshall would hold that post until his death in 1834, and there's very little question that John Marshall was and remains the most important judge in American history. The chief reason for this is that while Thomas Jefferson and his Republican allies took control of Congress and of the White House in the elections of 1800, 1801, and held this power down through the first quarter of the 19th century, that is, while the Jeffersonian Republicans were winning all the political battles, John Marshall, as Chief Justice, saw to it that the Hamiltonian position and people who advocated it were actually winning the war. In a series of decisions handed down by John Marshall and his fellow justices on the Supreme Court, the Marshall Court instantiated the Hamiltonian reading of the Constitution, or you might say the Hamiltonian approach to the Constitution, into what lawyers and law professors commonly call constitutional law. Here we encounter an important phenomenon in American political life, the distinction between the Constitution and so-called constitutional law. So on one hand, we have the written Constitution as it was explained to people while it was pending before them in the ratification process. That's what Thomas Jefferson said should be the test of the Constitution's meaning. We have that on one hand. And on the other hand, we have this constitutional law, which is the body of court decisions purportedly implementing the Constitution. There is a great disjunct between the Constitution itself and so-called constitutional law, and this disjunct began to be very evident during the Chief Justiceship of John Marshall. In order to understand the situation, we have to know that, again, the Jeffersonians won control of both the elected branches of the federal government in the 1800 elections, and we have to have some understanding of what the Federalists decided they would do about that. In 1801, the Federalists passed a new Judiciary Act that had several provisions, and apparently its intention was both to take advantage of experience in reorganizing the federal judiciary slightly from the structure that had been created by the Judiciary Act of 1789 that created the federal judiciary in the first place, and to implant Federalist appointees in the new courts and new judgeships that were created by the Act, so that due to the life tenure, or what the Constitution calls good behavior tenure, provided by the Constitution, those people would be in a position, insofar as possible, to check the Jeffersonian majorities now coming to control the rest of the federal government. The myth that the Republicans held sacred for a long time after the transition from Federalist to Republican control of the federal government in 1801, the myth was that John Adams, in his last days in office, was hurriedly putting what came to be called the midnight judges into these new federal judicial positions. So the idea here is that even as his party was preparing to leave office, John Adams spent his evenings signing commissions of new judicial appointees he had selected specifically with the purpose of thwarting the people's will as represented by the legislative enactments of the Jeffersonian Republican majority. When the Republicans came to control of the new Congress in 1801, one of the first things they did was pass legislation repealing the Judiciary Act of 1801. And there was some conflict among the Federalists on the federal courts over the question what to do about this. Many of them, including Chief Justice Marshall, believed that the repeal of the Judiciary Act of 1801 was unconstitutional. That is, they believed that insofar as it deprived some federal judges of their positions, it violated the promise of good behavior tenure found in Article 3. And there were some members of the federal judiciary who wanted to confront the elected branches on this question. Marshall, however, was always more pragmatic, and he decided this really wasn't worth the argument, even though he had not only an ideological commitment to the wrongness of the new legislation, but also a family interest, since his own brother had been appointed as one of the so-called midnight judges. Anyway, the bottom line is that the Federalists decided not to make an issue of it on the judiciary. However, the question of the midnight judges did come to a head in one of the most widely discussed and long remembered of Supreme Court decisions, maybe the most famous Supreme Court decision before Brown versus Board of Education in 1954, and that was in the 1803 case of Marbury versus Madison. When Thomas Jefferson became president and appointed his best friend James Madison Secretary of State, Madison found that alongside his new diplomatic duties as America's foreign minister, effectively, as Secretary of State, he also had some administrative duties. And one of those was, well, apparently, to deliver these commissions. Actually, when Jefferson, in his old age, wrote an autobiographical sketch, he said that on coming to office, he found that commissions for some of the so-called midnight judges were waiting in the Secretary of State's office. You can kind of imagine James Madison walking into his office as Secretary of State and finding a stack of papers on the desk. And Jefferson said in old age that he decided those would not be delivered. That is, that despite the fact that the President Adams had nominated people and the Senate had confirmed the nominations, the commissions, the kind of licenses to exercise these offices would not be delivered. And that would thwart, again, it would thwart the attempt of the Federalists to ensconce their ideological allies in these new judicial positions. Well, William Marbury, the plaintiff in the case of Marbury versus Madison, was, or the complainant, if you want to say it that way, was one of the people who had not had his commission delivered. And he had been appointed to the relatively insignificant post of Justice of the Peace for the District of Columbia, a very, very minor judicial post. But he decided to take the case to the Supreme Court and ask for what was called a writ of mandamus, which is an official order from a judge to an executive official to do his duty. And it's not about a policy question, but about a simple administrative task. In this case, it would have been an order to James Madison, the Secretary of State, to deliver Mr. Marbury's commission to him. So the court unanimously decided the questions, the issue, and announced its decision, which apparently was written by Chief Justice Marshall. According to Marshall in Marbury versus Madison in 1803, there are really three questions facing the court here. The first one was whether Marbury had a right to his commission. And the court had no difficulty in answering this question, yes. That is, the Constitution provided that the president could make appointments with the advice and consent of the Senate. The president had made the nomination, the Senate had voted to confirm Mr. Marbury's appointment, and so advice and consent of the Senate had been secured. Not only that, but John Adams had signed the commission. So there was nothing left to be done except hand the guy the paper. And according to Marshall, Mr. Marbury had a right to that commission. The second question, Marshall said, was whether there was a remedy, whether the law provided some solution to this problem of Jefferson's and Madison's not delivering the commission. And Marshall said, yes, there was a remedy, and that was a writ of mandamus. The third question was whether the Supreme Court had power to issue a writ of mandamus. Now, the Judiciary Act of 1789 purported to empower the Supreme Court to hear suits for mandamus. And here Marshall took up the question what Article 3 said about the powers of the Supreme Court. Article 3, in describing the federal judiciary, says there will be a Supreme Court with the Chief Justice and such inferior courts as Congress from time to time may ordain and establish. It says that the Supreme Court will have original jurisdiction. That is, you start a lawsuit in only a few kinds of cases, cases between two states, cases between a minister of a foreign government and the United States. There are four or five kinds of cases. And then beyond that, it says that in other cases, the Supreme Court's jurisdiction will be appellate. So according to Marshall, the question then became, well, what was the provision of the Judiciary Act of 1789 that gave the Supreme Court jurisdiction over suits for mandamus consistent with this listing of kinds of suits that Congress could empower the Supreme Court to hear in the first place? Was it among the kinds of original jurisdiction that Article 3 said the Supreme Court would have? And he said, no, it's not. And in fact, he said, and again, remember, this is a unanimous decision of the court, so all the justices agreed. What they said was that the list of kinds of cases over which the Supreme Court would have original jurisdiction was exhaustive. That is, Congress couldn't add to it. So if the Supreme Court was going to hear cases about writs of mandamus, it could only do so on appeal. Well, then, if Mr. Marbury or anyone like him wanted to initiate a suit for mandamus, he would have to do so in another court. It would have to be either a state court, which wouldn't be able to issue an order to the Secretary of State, or would have to be a lower federal court in case Congress decided to empower one to do that, which Congress had not done. Anyway, what had happened here then was that Marshall had undertaken, the court had undertaken, to exercise the very important power of judicial review. This is the first case in which the Supreme Court said, we have this federal statute, but we're not going to recognize its validity because it's inconsistent with the Constitution. Or in other words, this is the way we more commonly put it now, the court decided to strike down that portion of the Judiciary Act of 1789 that purported to extend original jurisdiction over suits for writs of mandamus to the Supreme Court. Notice that there's a bit of political genius in this, because what Marshall had done was to castigate Jefferson and Madison for not delivering Marbury's commission and at the same time give them nothing they could do in response. If he had ordered Madison to deliver the commission, apparently Jefferson had decided he was not going to do it anyway. But to give him the order, he's still not going to do it. On the other hand, by saying, well, you should do this, but we can't make you because we don't have original jurisdiction over this kind of case, Marshall had succeeded both in publicly criticizing Jefferson and Madison and in denying them any way of ignoring what he was saying. That is, they could not disdain his decision because he wasn't telling them to do anything. And at the time, this was a controversial, at least in Jefferson's mind, this was controversial behavior. Not that people generally disliked the idea of judicial review. It's true that in New York, some anti-federalists objected to the idea of judicial review, but in Virginia's ratification convention, both sides, the Federalists who wanted to ratify the Constitution without amending it first, and the anti-federalists, or the Republicans as they called themselves, who wanted to amend the Constitution before it was ratified, both sides in Virginia thought that the power of judicial review was a good thing and it would be good if federal judges exercised it. So that was not a controversial element of Marbury. But what was controversial was the public political lecture that John Marshall effectively gave the Jefferson administration, the two highest officials in the federal executive, Jefferson and Madison. And one other point we should make about Marbury versus Madison is that it's commonly said that the power to exercise this function of judicial review was invented or was first claimed by the federal judiciary in Marbury versus Madison, and that's a mistake. As Gerber's collection Seriatim, which is a group of short biographies of the early Supreme Court justices, shows, the power of judicial review had already been exercised by federal courts in several cases, but not by the Supreme Court. In fact, there had been several Circuit Court of Appeals cases in which Supreme Court justices sitting on these appellate courts had exercised the power of judicial review. So it was not novel in that sense. Anyway, what Marbury versus Madison did then, besides staking out the claim on behalf of the Supreme Court for a power of judicial review, was to solidify in Thomas Jefferson's mind the idea that the federal courts, led by his Federalist cousin, John Marshall, were a hostile force. As they took power over Congress, the Republicans decided they were going to do something about the nakedly political behavior in which the federal judiciary had been engaged in the period 1798 to 1801. Remember in our lecture about the crisis of 1798, we saw that federal judges were very enthusiastic about enforcing the Sedition Act, and I described Justice Chase's behavior in that episode. Well, one way that the Republicans wanted to try to rein in the federal judiciary and prevent it from pursuing this or going further down this path of nakedly political behavior was by using the old English power of impeachment, which Congress had been given by the people through the Constitution. And so, among other things, one of the first acts that were taken by the new Republican majority in Congress was to impeach a federal district judge from New Hampshire. This judge's name was Pickering, and he was impeached for, well, people said that he would show up to his court intoxicated from having imbibed too many alcoholic beverages. And he would slur his words, he would read charges to juries incorrectly, he didn't seem to be able to follow evidence, and it seemed that he was just not fulfilling the duties of his office. So the House of Representatives impeached him under the provision of the Constitution that says that the high executive and judicial officials can be, high civil officials, can be impeached by the House and removed on conviction by the Senate on for treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. And so the House impeached Judge Pickering. In the trial in the Senate, the question whether Pickering was showing up to court mentally impaired was not really contested, but the issue was whether he had committed any high crime or misdemeanor. Remember, he could be impeached and removed on conviction in the Senate for treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. Well, obviously, showing up drunk to court would not have been treason, it would not have been bribery, that left high crimes and misdemeanors. His son sent a letter to the Senate objecting to the case against his father by saying, "My father is not a drunk, rather, he's got dementia." That is, his son said that there was some early onset Alzheimer's or some kind of mental malady that made it seem that Judge Pickering was intoxicated, even though really he was not. Then the question became, as it was framed by the defense counsel, by the counsel for the judge, whether this was really a high crime or misdemeanor. Suppose you were demented. Would that be a high crime? Would that be a misdemeanor? There was confusion, and this remains in the Senate's precedents all the way down to the present. There was confusion over the question exactly what high crimes and misdemeanors were. Now, in English law, as Raoul Berger, the late great legal historian from Harvard Law School and author of the fabulous book Impeachment, the Constitutional Problems, as Raoul Berger framed it, in English law, high crimes or misdemeanors certainly did include political offenses, but they also included mental and physical disability. So if one were hit in the head with a board and suddenly unable to perform his task in any way, while this would not mean that the fellow had suddenly some kind of moral opprobrium attached to him, still he would be unable to fulfill the duties of his office and he could be removed. The other provision of the Constitution that actually would have provided a remedy here was the statement that judges would hold their office during good behavior. In English law, this kind of tenure was terminable through what was called a writ of scare facias. You could go to a judge and say, well, that judge is mentally disabled, and so he's no longer performing his functions, he's no longer exercising good behavior, and that was a way that you could terminate the office of somebody who held office during good behavior. So essentially, the impeachment provision was about political crimes, and the good behavior tenure was about at least in English law, was about physical, emotional, mental, other debility. The Senate, however, was subjected to the argument that, well, high crimes and misdemeanors are things for which one might be indicted. And so the defense counsel blurred or confused the two categories of political crimes for which one under the Constitution's provisions could be removed from his office. Abuse of office, for example, is the main thing that the impeachment provisions were actually about, and common criminal offenses for which one might be indicted and tried before a petit jury of his peers. And the Senate, ultimately in the Pickering proceeding, didn't really decide these questions. They just voted to remove him from office without really saying what this had to do with high crimes or misdemeanors. The next case that the Senate took up, however, did more clearly raise these questions, and in a way that the Senate actually was going to have to resolve in resolving the case. And that was in the impeachment of Justice Samuel Chase. Now, Berger, again, in his fabulous book, characterizes Justice Chase as probably the one man in American history who most deserved to be impeached and convicted. Because what Chase had done was that while the Sedition Act was the law of the land, he had, as a circuit judge, that is, while serving on an intermediate level federal appellate court in Maryland, had told people in Maryland that he had seen a book that was published by a Virginia resident named James Thompson Callender. The book was critical of John Adams, and Justice Chase in Maryland said, "When I get to Richmond on my circuit duties, I'm going to impanel a grand jury. I'm going to have them indict this Callender. There's going to be a trial. He's going to be convicted. And then I'm going to throw the book at him." And that's exactly what he did. When he got to Richmond, he basically gave the grand jury no choice but to indict the fellow. Then at the trial, he wouldn't let defense counsel present their evidence. In fact, going so far as to cut off one defense witness who was former and future U.S. Senator John Taylor of Caroline, one of the very, very most prominent Jeffersonian Republicans. And besides that, Justice Chase, in front of the jurors, and actually to the jurors, mocked defense counsel, called them names bearing on their competency, forced one of them to resign from the case. The one attorney said, "Well, if you're not going to allow me to present my evidence, there's no way I can mount an adequate defense." And so he left the case. When finally Callender was convicted, Justice Chase did throw the book at him. He gave him both a significant fine and a prison term. For what? Well, of course, for criticizing President Adams, which involved Justice Chase in doing what other Federalist judges were doing, and that was ignoring the 10th and 1st Amendments by allowing the Sedition Act to be used to cow opposition to President Adams. When they had the trial he was impeached for abusing his office in a political sense by the House of Representatives. And when they had the trial in the Senate, the issue that was raised was by his defense counsel, by Chase's counsel, was essentially the same one as had been raised in the Pickering case. But here you didn't have the question of mental debility, perhaps resulting from illness or degenerative ailment. Instead, it was just clear that what Chase had done was not a common criminal offense. Instead, it was a political crime, that of abusing his office. And by the narrowest margin possible, the Senate decided not to remove Justice Chase. So they let this completely unfit judge remain on the bench. And again, Berger decries this. Now, federal judges, of course, have learned to love this. In fact, the late Chief Justice William Rehnquist, in his history of the Supreme Court, says this was a fabulous vindication of the idea that American judges were not going to be political, that expressions of opinion weren't going to be the ground for removing people from office. But what was at issue in the Chase impeachment? What were at issue were not Justice Chase's opinions. What was at issue was the fact that he had identified people he was going to have convicted before they were even tried. And he had decided people would be indicted before the grand juries were even impaneled. He'd been the very picture of a hanging judge, and one might have thought that this was totally unlike the way an American judge ought to behave. When President Jefferson heard about the outcome in the Senate trial of Justice Chase, his comment was to the effect that, well, the impeachment provisions are obviously completely worthless. And so he was highly disappointed over the outcome of the Chase impeachment. The next episode in which there was a serious conflict between the federal judiciary and the Republicans now in control of the elected branches of the federal government was the treason trial of Aaron Burr. Now, Burr had been the man who was elected vice president when Jefferson was elected president. In fact, he, along with Jefferson and Madison, was one of the three founders of the Jeffersonian Republican Party. It was Burr's success in swinging New York State behind Jefferson's and his own candidacy in 1800-1801 that ensured that John Adams would not be reelected. And yet, because in the conflict over the presidency in the House of Representatives, Burr did not make any public statement saying that the House should definitely elect Jefferson over him. He was effectively persona non grata from the beginning of the Jefferson administration. Now, in 1805, he was succeeded by a different vice president, and it seems, at least what he was accused of, was that he had committed treason. So, although it remains very murky, even to the present, what exactly was going on in this, the story we can piece together is that Burr and several dozen other men were going down the Ohio and Mississippi rivers. They intended eventually to get to more or less Texas, maybe western Louisiana, and the argument that was going to be made by the Jefferson administration's attorneys was that the plan here was to form some kind of southwestern empire or republic with Burr at the head of it. Well, Burr was captured by American agents. He was taken to Richmond, where he was indicted. And ultimately, he was tried by a court in Richmond presided over by Chief Justice John Marshall, Circuit Justice for Richmond. Marshall, it seems, perhaps accidentally, at least this is the argument of one of his recent biographers, perhaps accidentally, but at least we know that it happened, that while Burr was being tried for treason before Chief Justice Marshall, there was a public event, a kind of party at some of the elite politicians' place in Richmond, and there in attendance were both Marshall and Burr. Ultimately, what happened in the trial of Aaron Burr was that Burr's counsel subpoenaed President Jefferson. They wanted the various answers from Jefferson. They wanted various documents from Jefferson. Jefferson refused to cooperate, saying that he didn't have to answer subpoenas from the judiciary, except insofar as he decided it was advisable to do so. And for his part, apparently thinking, at least we can infer, that thinking that Burr was not being allowed to put on an adequate defense, Marshall ultimately stressed to the jury what the Constitution says about treason. Treason in English law had been a very capacious category of offenses. It was a kind of grab bag from which persecuting people in control of the executive could grab something that would allow them to get rid of their political opponents. And so people had been executed for treason in England over many centuries for various things. And the American Constitution writers had decided they didn't want to have such a broad latitude of treason indictments and prosecutions. So treason was defined narrowly in the Constitution. And besides that, the Constitution says that every act committed in the course of treason had to be attested in court either by open admission of the defendant or sworn testimony of at least two witnesses. Now, the prosecution in the Burr case did not have two witnesses for everything Burr had done. You might think, well, of course, it's treason. It's going to be done in secret. Well, more or less. But that was the way the Constitution was intended to work, as a bar to easy prosecution of people for treason. So ultimately, given the instructions that were given to the jury by Chief Justice Marshall, Burr was acquitted of treason. And here, Thomas Jefferson said that he thought that Marshall had behaved in a partisan fashion. I think actually that this is one of the low points of the Jefferson administration. Jefferson was behaving here somewhat similarly to the way that, maybe less extremely, but somewhat similarly to the way that Justice Chase had behaved. Jefferson certainly made clear to people that he hoped that Burr would be convicted. And nowadays, of course, we've become used to the idea that presidents and governors, when trials are proceeding, will say, well, we'll just have to let justice take its course, or he'll be prosecuted according to the provision of the law, or that kind of thing. They don't say, well, I hope he's convicted, because it's seen as a way to kind of poison the well of what we hope will be a neutral jury. And this certainly was not any spectacular episode in the Jefferson record. Besides the Marbury versus Madison decision and the decision not to confront the Republicans over the repeal of the Judiciary Act of 1801, there were several other very significant decisions that were handed down by the Supreme Court under the chief justiceship of John Marshall. I'm going to talk about just a few of the most important ones. First, in 1810, the court decided a case called Fletcher versus Peck. Now, Fletcher versus Peck is important for two reasons. One is that it was an attempted judicial resolution of the Yazoo scandal, which I mentioned in talking in another lecture about the Jefferson administration. Ultimately, the Yazoo scandal centered on a series of events in Georgia in which the legislature of Georgia decided to sell the overwhelming majority of today's Alabama and Mississippi for a song. You could get an acre for a few cents. And ultimately, the people of Georgia were so, I would say, disconsolate, but they were also angry as a result of the outcome here, that at the next election, well, they intended to vote out a lot of legislators. But then by then it had become clear that the land companies that had made a lot of the purchases of this land actually had bribed legislators. All but one of them had taken money from the investors who bought these land titles at next to nothing per acre. And so all but one of the legislators were tossed out at the next election. Well, the new legislature came in and repealed the act selling the land. They said this was a swindle, it's a fraud, it's not a valid contract, and we're repealing it. And what was decided in Fletcher versus Peck in 1810 was that a state law impairing the obligation of contracts violated the Contracts Clause of the Constitution and therefore would be held unconstitutional. Notice what the Marshall Court did not address was the question whether there actually was a contract here. What is a land grant a contract? Well, probably not. Is a fraudulently obtained land grant a valid contract? Well, we actually have similar language to the Contracts Clause of the Constitution in the Northwest Ordinance of 1787. And there, the explicit exception is made for fraudulent contracts. That is, that it was understood by people at the time, well, of course, a state wouldn't be bound, or individuals in a state wouldn't be bound by fraud, but Marshall here decided this case in favor of the land companies, essentially. And there are two things to note about this. First is that the people who were saying that the state of Georgia should not be allowed to rescind the fraudulently obtained conveyance of this land, many of the people who were making this argument were Federalists from New England, that is, political soulmates of Marshall's. And another point to note is that Marshall himself was a notable land speculator. He and his brother were members of a major land investment company that had extensive lands in the Midwest and Kentucky and West Virginia. And so Marshall tended to be sympathetic with people who claimed land titles from state governments. But the chief principle for which Fletcher versus Peck stands now is that one can have the federal courts declare provisions of state law invalid as incommensurate with or inconsistent with provisions of the Constitution. This is the first case in which that was done. So in other words, state laws inconsistent with the Constitution will be struck down by federal courts. That's the chief significance of Fletcher versus Peck. In In 1816, the court decided another case along similar lines, what was called Martin versus Hunter's lessee. And here, one of the parties was actually the land company in which Chief Justice Marshall and his brother were investors. So Marshall recused himself, that is, didn't formally participate in the court's deliberations in this case, but instead the court's decision was written by Marshall's right-hand man and the first law professor at Harvard, Joseph Story. Story, in Martin versus Hunter's lessee, the court was considering the question of the validity of another provision of the Judiciary Act of 1789. That one was Section 25 of the Judiciary Act. Section 25 of the Judiciary Act of 1789 said that one could appeal decisions concerning federal law from state supreme courts to the federal supreme court. Now, in other words, if you had a legal case come up through your state courts all the way to the Supreme Court of your state, and you didn't like the outcome, at least in regard to the federal law questions in that case, then you could appeal from your state Supreme Court to the federal Supreme Court. So Martin versus Hunter's lessee involved a case from Virginia in which the question essentially had to do with the enforceability against Virginia law of provisions of the Treaty of Paris that settled the American Revolution. And so the leading party didn't like the outcome regarding federal law in the Virginia Court of Appeals, which is now called the Virginia Supreme Court, and so appealed the case to the U.S. Supreme Court. Well, when the United States Supreme Court sent a writ to the Virginia Court of Appeals saying, send us your records so we can hear the appeal of this case, the Virginia Supreme Court, that is the Virginia Court of Appeals at the time, answered, no, we don't do that. You can't hear appeals of our cases because we're a coordinate body. We're not an inferior body to you. So the theory that the judges on the Virginia Court of Appeals had was that in America we have two court systems. We have state courts and we have federal courts. It's not that the federal courts are above the state courts, it's that the two of them work side by side. So, according to the Virginia Court of Appeals judges, the people on the Virginia Court of Appeals had sworn to uphold the Constitution. They were going to be applying it in the same way as a federal court would. And if you didn't like the outcome in a lower court in Virginia, you could appeal to the Virginia Court of Appeals. But then you couldn't take an appeal from the Virginia Court of Appeals to the U.S. Supreme Court, because it was not the job of people on the federal courts to be telling state supreme courts what to do. Well, Story said, no, clearly the Constitution envisions that there will be this one court for the whole country that will decide these questions in the last resort and maintain a uniformity from state to state of interpretation of various questions of federal law. And so if you study constitutional law, in a college, in a university, in a law school, you're told Martin versus Hunter's lessee established the principle that Section 25 of the Judiciary Act was constitutional. Congress did have power to let federal Supreme Court hear appeals from state Supreme Courts when it had to do with federal law. What they don't tell you is that when Story had written his opinion for the Supreme Court, he then sent a writ to the Virginia Court of Appeals saying, send us your records, and the Virginia Court of Appeals didn't answer. So this, like Fletcher versus Peck, actually, that one also was not enforced. This decision was never enforced. But the point is, it established the principle. So hearing of these kinds of decisions, and there were several others, we don't have time to go into all of them, but hearing of these kinds of decisions, Thomas Jefferson in retirement was becoming disconsolate. And at one point he wrote that the federal judges are like a corps of sappers and miners who are always working to undermine our citadel, right? Sappers and miners in the old days when fortifications, castles, big earthen works, were important in military affairs. A sapper or a miner was somebody who would dig under a wall that the attacking army couldn't make its way through. But if you dug under a gigantic wall and eventually blew up the ground under the wall, then you could expect the wall to fall down, while somebody who was just attacking the wall itself would not be able to knock it down. So this image from Jefferson of federal judges as sappers and miners working to undermine the Constitution had to do with the fact that As in Fletcher versus Peck and Martin versus Hunter's lessee, very commonly the martial court decisions were saying that the federal government was essentially more like a national government. Or another way to put it is that it was more Hamiltonian than the people had agreed to in the ratification process, certainly more Hamiltonian than the Jeffersonians believed it ought to be. The most important of the martial court decisions, I would argue, even more important than Marbury versus Madison, was the case of McCulloch versus Maryland. McCulloch versus Maryland was decided by the Supreme Court in 1819, and this is another decision that was written by Chief Justice Marshall for a unanimous court. And what was at issue here was the constitutionality of the federal legislation chartering the Second Bank of the United States. So recall that Hamilton had asked Congress in 1791 to charter the Bank of the United States. Madison had objected that it was unconstitutional. Jefferson had echoed Madison's argument in the cabinet, but ultimately President Washington accepted Alexander Hamilton's argument that essentially Congress could do anything related to the economy, so long as the Constitution did not say in regard to that particular thing, Congress may not do this. The way that Hamilton put it was where the ends are legitimate and the means are not prohibited, the means are constitutional. And yet in 1811, after the 20 chartered years had run, the Congress considered the question of extending the charter of the Bank of the United States and decided not to. Madison had wanted it to, but he had not made a public issue of it, and the Congress, thinking, well, this is our position, we're Republicans here, killed it. Then after the War of 1812 ended, Madison decided, you know, it would be much more convenient if we had a Bank of the United States. It would make it easier to service the old revolutionary debt, which we had not yet extinguished when the war began, and the new debt, which we've run up during the War of 1812. And so he asked Congress to charter a new bank. You might think at that point, okay, Congress's power to charter a bank is no longer controversial. The Federalists favor it. Now Madison favors it. Everybody favors it. But that would be to overlook the fact that Republicans were not all persuaded by Madison. In fact, there were several states in which Republican majorities in the legislatures remained opposed to the idea of a federally chartered bank. And so some of them passed laws saying, well, you can't operate a bank that was chartered, not chartered by our state legislature in this state. Or a couple of other states adopted laws saying you have to pay a high annual fee if you want to operate a bank that wasn't chartered or a corporation that wasn't chartered by our state legislature in this state. One state that did that was Maryland. And actually, there's been some talk that this was a setup case, that the reason the court took the appeal of McCulloch versus Maryland very quickly was that the court actually just wanted to hurry up and decide this question. And what happened in McCulloch versus Maryland was that, as in Marbury versus Madison, which echoed Hamilton's arguments about judicial review in Federalist 78, in McCulloch, what Marshall did was essentially borrow Hamilton's argument from the cabinet debate with Jefferson. He basically took Hamilton's memorandum on the bank bill in 1791 and made the same exact argument. Sure, there are powers listed in Article 1, Section 8, but beyond that, there's a necessary and proper clause. Who's to decide what's necessary or proper, which means really helpful or useful in putting those powers into effect? Well, it has to be Congress. So is there nothing Congress is disallowed to do? Well, yes, there's some things the Constitution says it can't do, but Congress isn't doing any of those things here. Chartering a bank is not an ex post facto law, for example. So he concludes, as Hamilton had done, where the ends are legitimate and the means are not prohibited, the means are constitutional. So ultimately, the court went on record with this Hamiltonian view of the powers of Congress. And we see in Fletcher, the court said, we're going to take an active role in striking down state legislation. In Martin versus Hunter's lessee, they said, yes, we will supervise the behavior of federal judiciaries. And then in McCulloch versus Maryland, they said, essentially, Congress can do more or less anything it wants. That helps to tell you why Jefferson was so unhappy with his cousin Marshall on the Supreme Court. And, you know, we're winning all the battles, and yet those other guys are winning the war. So we win all the elections, and what good does it do? And Jefferson ultimately concluded that the one great flaw in the system created by the Constitution was that there was no check on the judiciary when it came to exercising this power of judicial review, especially after the incorrect decision of the Chase impeachment by the Senate. There's only one significant, really significant case involving the Constitution in which John Marshall decided against federal authority, and that was the 1833 case of Barron versus Baltimore. Mr. Barron was the owner of a pier in Baltimore. That is, Baltimore is the main port on Chesapeake Bay, and there was a pier there that was owned by Mr. Barron, which was a place where ships could tie up and unload their cargo onto the dock, or they could load cargo from the dock. What happened was that the city of Baltimore decided that various rainstorms were making it obvious that the roads in Baltimore were going to continue to be ruined by runoff unless something were done. And so they regraded the roads. They redirected some of the streams running through the town into the bay. You might think, well, that's a good public works project, unless you were Mr. Barron. Because what happened when the streams were redirected was that silt built up around his pier and made it, as he insisted, effectively unusable. So Mr. Barron sued the city of Baltimore. He said, under the Fifth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, you can't take private property for public use without giving me just compensation. I demand that you give me the old market value of my pier from the time before you effectively ruined it, deprived me of its use by building silt up around it through this regrading project. And John Marshall, for the unanimous Supreme Court, said, nope, sorry, Mr. Barron, you lose. And what he said was that people know, as they knew at the time, that the reason the first 10 amendments were added to the Constitution was that the opponents of the Constitution's ratification had instilled fear in people that the new federal government was being given too many powers. And so the reason for the Bill of Rights was to clarify the limits of the power of the federal government. The limits then imposed by the first 8 amendments to the Constitution were intended to apply only to the federal government, not to the state governments. And Baltimore was a part of the state of Maryland. The city of Baltimore as a legal entity was created by Maryland, not by the federal government. So he told Mr. Barron, if you're to have a remedy at law, you must take this up with the state government, whether the city of Baltimore or the courts or your fellow citizens in amending the Constitution or in some other way, the legislature, you must take this up with Maryland. Anyway, the bottom line is that although in that one case, Marshall ruled against a claim of federal authority, in general, Marshall's court stood for the idea of an expansive reading of the federal judiciary against the state legislatures, an expansive reading of the power of the federal judiciary against state courts, an expansive reading of the extent of federal versus state legislative authority. And this is why Thomas Jefferson lamented it. So, as I said before, you have to make a distinction in considering the American constitutional system between the actual Constitution and what's called constitutional law. To a large, well, really what we live under today is not the Constitution, it's constitutional law. And to a large extent, the distinction between the two traces back to the years when John Marshall was Chief Justice.